And we obviously don't have enough chairs. Jerry, could you join us as well? Luis? Let me give you a comment first, since there's no room for you in here.
Yeah, just a quick comment. I think we're making the assumption that, from the synaptic strengthening hypothesis, we're making the assumption that sleep is good for your cortex rather than good for your brain. And it seems to me that if sleep has evolved in many different ways, with many different strategies, in many different organisms who even don't have cortex, seems to me that really the function of the sleep is completely independent of the cortex and is completely independent of strengthening synapses in the cortex. It's probably more important for survival to strengthen and to maintain synapses in the hypothalamus or in the striatum rather than strengthening performance in the long run. That's one point I want to make. And in general, really, the idea that the sleep is for the brain and by the brain is true, but we're only measuring surface electrical activity in the cortex, and that's really not, by any means, the whole picture. That was kind of a one point to start the discussion, maybe.
So I'm sorry, but I you put up your first slide, Giulio, and had the null hypothesis, and my brain locked onto that. And I didn't hear your talk because I prepared a counter-argument to claiming this. I find this extremely strange to say sleep has no function, a null hypothesis. Sleep has to serve behavioral adaptation or it would not be here. Adaptation is survival. Think from a behavior, it's not a cognitive orientation. Sleep's a forced state of behavioral inactivity relative to an environment, in particular relative to light-dark cycle. Nearly every living organism on the planet is forced into some temporal niche, usually around that photoperiod. I would argue for adaptive reasons, having to do with your ability to cope, find food, reproduce, avoid predation. I think sleep-initiating mechanisms account for the waking deficits. In other words, I think everything we're seeing is sleep trying to turn on naturally. It's just, which means it's consistent with the notion and that sleep is really resetting, it's resetting wake pressure, a wake time constant. And we think we know that time constant's around 16 hours. And Alan Pack showed one of my slides here today. I didn't go into this in great detail, but it isn't sleep debt that matters. This is a forced timeout. Now, it makes good sense that part of behavioral adaptation would include remembering where food was yesterday or who was a threat to you or what you learned to do things so that the brain has some activity around memory that it engages in to make sure that you're still behaviorally efficient when you're back online again. But I'm just throwing that out there to suggest that it's really not appropriate to say either it has no function or it must have a cognitive function. I would argue that what it's got in the Darwinian sense is behavioral adaptation. It's about survival. That's the null hypothesis. In fact, I'm not even sure that's the null because I don't think you can have sleep. I don't think you can talk about this state at all unless you admit that that has to be part of it. How else does it survive? How else does it continue to be carried genetically in variations on a theme in life forms? That's my point.
But I think you want to be careful not to talk about the function of sleep. I mean, I've given the analogy of if you heard two tongue researchers having an argument where one of them is saying, well, you know, the function of the tongue is to taste food, and the other one says, no, the function of the tongue is to articulate speech. And they go back and forth arguing, we would quickly decide that they were both demented or sleep-deprived at least. I mean, it obviously serves both functions. And I think, strange in the sleep field, we still have a tendency to argue about the function of sleep. And I think that's just a poorly formed question. It clearly contributes to immunological function of the body. It clearly contributes to regulation of glucose regulatory mechanisms of the body. I think it clearly contributes to regulation of cognitive functions in the brain. And to try to break these apart and say that one's the real function, the other is either maybe to say that they're ancillary or to say that they don't exist is sort of a futile argument. I was struck by something that Giulio said near the start in his list that he didn't come back to, which was, why do we have to lose awareness of our environment? What is it that sleep can offer us that we couldn't get by going into a deep meditative state, to go into just a quiet resting state? Why do we have to go all the way to unconsciousness with its inevitable risk of being unable to monitor your environment? And it seems to me that for that particular question, I mean, for immune functions and glucose regulatory functions, I can't come up with an answer. But it's very clear that unlike a VCR, which can be recording one channel and sending another channel to your television screen, our brains only have single regions to do that kind of processing. You see it all the time. If I'm speaking and I say something that strikes you as interesting and you stop and think about it a second, you stop listening to me. You can't do them both. So if you have an evolutionary pressure, a need to take time to replay, to review, to reconsider prior information that came in, something that we in our profession really piss and moan about a lot, that we spend so much time on that we have no time off to think about what we're saying and whether I should have said that or not. We don't have time for those sorts of thoughts. That maybe the reason that we go offline in sleep is to provide a state where the brain can bring those images back up, which it wouldn't be able to do if it was trying simultaneously to monitor the environment.
Well, can I pick up on that? And another thing that point Giulio made was that, in fact, we do have during the day these intrusions, right? Daydreaming, it's called. And it's for briefer amounts of time. It doesn't last for hours. It lasts for a few seconds, a minute, where it's clear that ideas are popping into your head and they're coming from somewhere and it's not being triggered by an immediate stimulus. It may have had something to do with something that happened recently. So it's clear that, you know, why not? Isn't that good enough? I mean, so here's a hypothesis that I think could unify all the different functions, right? What do they have in common? So let's assume that, in fact, it's the immune system that benefits, it's parts of the brain that benefits, maybe the synapses benefit. Why do you need hours? So there are certain biochemical reactions, especially those that involve regulating genes, turning genes on and off, and simply the time it takes to create, to go from the gene to proteins. There are some proteins, for example, that take tens of minutes, big proteins, to translate off the mRNA. And then once you've made the proteins, you still have to take them somewhere. You have to transport. And transport system in neurons can be slow because neurons have some dendrites that are millimeters long, and it takes hours to transport the materials. So one of the things that could happen during sleep, and not just in the brain but in any cell that requires a lot of gene transcription in order to be able to undergo some important repair function or enhancement function, is simply take it offline, turn on the factory, let it crank out, and so it's not being interfered with by sensory input coming in or demands that you have to run, and let all of that biochemistry take place, whatever has to be done, and let it come to completion before you have to go online again. So it's kind of the offline version, and then that could be used for any function. So is this maybe a unifying principle that may be true for all of the different functions?
But sir,
this is true for sleep cycle length. That sleep cycle length varies with the size of the brain, with the size of the animal. It's a very tight correlation, one which usually gets ignored because it's so hard to put it in some framework, as you've just done. And the best idea is that there's something that diffuses where the actual physical size of the brain becomes an issue. An elephant has a sleep cycle last 2 hours, a mouse, you know, 10 minutes. And this varies systematically with size of brain. It's one of the best correlations across species.
Well, I want to comment on this one because what you mentioned and what you reminded us of is something we have thought a lot about, and because indeed the transport processes have something to do with the duration of non-REM-REM cycle. And how important that is in animals that don't have REM, of course, is a different story. Maybe it relates to some general ultradian cycle that there is, whether there is REM or not. But one of the interesting things that might happen in this more speculative realm is that, for instance, there are mitochondria who have two, which are, of course, the furnaces of the brain and every other cell. And in the brain, they need to travel very far to go down to the tip of the axon where they are concentrated, and in the distal dendrites near the synapse, where the energy indeed is consumed the most. And that for a long time was to me one of the most appealing notions about what sleep might be for because of that correlation. One of the questions that remains, though, is, for instance, the data we have about certain, and new data, some of those, certain neurons in the brain. They do not seem to sleep ever. And certain neurons that always seem to sleep to some extent in terms of firing in the brainstem. Then there are data which are complicated about the muscle. That is, one of the typical things that's being said is that the muscle doesn't need sleep. It just needs rest. Okay. So again, we have the question, can we do many of those things having to do with either mitochondrial transport, protein transport, etc., in a situation of quiet wakefulness? That is why, if you think, I always think of, you know, the American army expanding in Iraq these days when I think of the synaptic homeostasis hypothesis, or around the world. There is a time which you are required to send troops, supplies, things, energy all over. And the requests come in faster and faster, more and more frequent, in more and more places, and all you can do is send the stuff out. And then at some point, there has to be a time for consolidation, which is a stop.
Resupply.
Supply.
Sounds like a bad dream.
And, you know, what companies do all the often is say, we cut 10% everywhere. Okay.
NIH too.
So that seems to be a general rule of life, a very basic rule of life. And one of the questions is, and we're still struggling with that, obviously, what is the most important commodity, which is perhaps especially important for the brain, where you may want to have the time off? It could be mitochondrial transfer, it could be protein synthesis, and there is some evidence for that. And it could be that, really, the most important thing that happens during wakefulness that you strengthen synapses with all the consequences that are bad. I think these are not mutually exclusive.
But then David presented evidence that shows that if you break the sleep cycle in half and put it at two times, hours and hours apart, at least for his measures, there's no downside of dividing the night in half, which is a curious question. There's historical evidence that pre-Edison, back in the 1500s, 1600s, that people, in fact, would sleep for several hours in the night and then wake up for several hours and then go back to sleep. So all of you who have the 3-4 o'clock meanies where you wake up, that might actually be closer to the evolutionary norm for the species. Again, without good data for it, as David's frown correctly notes. And then the other point is just to say that Sarah Mednick's data, again, with naps, raises an interesting question. And maybe it's dealing with different functions that a nap has the benefit.
There's an assumption behind your comment, which is that when you wake up, you reset, you go back to go. It might be that the supply chain stops halfway up, you wake up, it's still there.
Okay.
You go to nap, and now everything continues. In other words, the additive additive data that sleep is additive is, I don't think...
No, but Jerry's comment that the size of the brain correlates with the duration of the sleep bout rather than the total amount of sleep, I guess, was the question of whether that's...
Yeah, but it could be that, okay, it goes absolutely halfway up in half an hour, and so if you have a half hour, it goes halfway up, and you're halfway to the restoration.
So I have a question for the panel members around something that is generally ignored in the sleep field, and we have some data on it. I didn't show it, but the assumption is that when you're asleep, and you're in these complex stages, and you're doing various things that are also good for you, a very corticocentric view. But when you're awake, well, you're just awake. But yet the rest of the world thinks that what they do when they're awake really affects how tired they are, etc. In other words, what is the role of use of this biological machinery, cognition itself, the demands placed on it, in affecting these sleep processes. And I, for years, I wondered about this. We didn't look at it. So we did an experiment where we started varying workload. Now, this is incredibly simple. All we did was work people twice as long. Instead of working you a half hour out of every two throughout the days in these deprivation, we also took the same people, ran them again, and worked them for an hour out of every two. Then we took just the first part of their performance, the equivalent, say, initial 10 minutes on a task, okay, and compared them, and lo and behold, they're not different until we pass 16 hours of wakefulness. Then they're markedly different, with the ones we worked longer showing impairment in the initial part of their next test batteries. There's some contributory component from what we do when we're awake. So the question is, does wake intensity, that's what we call this concept, or cognitive intensity, fit in any of these models or ideas? Or?
Well, I, you probably were taken by the null hypothesis without seeing that I actually tried to destroy it. But I had a slide there that showed that indeed the quality of wakefulness in rats for the moment does make a difference.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Of course.
And that was actually the amount of exploration and learning that the rats did. Now, whether that compares to your increased workload, I don't know.
No, actually, I would readily accept that that's probably a very good animal model for that.
And so could I just ask something at this point? The talk about what's natural, how, you know, whether we used to nap a lot, now we need to insert naps in, whether 6 hours, 7 hours is optimal, or 8 hours and so on. Can we talk about whether the ethics of pushing the sleep-wake cycle, whether we actually want to do that, whether we should do that, whether we should be using modafinil, if athletes are precluded from using drugs, should we be using? Can we get into that?
So I would argue that, first of all, the first part of that question is, can we manipulate it willfully? And we do. And in fact, I think some of these variations in differential vulnerability to sleep loss, our ability to go a night without sleep and maintain fairly good behavioral integrity, are all signs that there's a fair amount of flexibility in this system, and that was probably demanded by being able to adapt. If it's too rigid, and nobody can function at all as soon as you pass your 16 hours or whatever, that's going to carry a terrible price for a species that started out following herding animals and killing them. So I think, in fact, there is flexibility in it. Then the question is, how far should we push that flexibility with environmental and chemical and other factors? And are there limits to it?
So Sarah would like to say something on that. And there's Sarah still here, Philip's still there, Eric. Eric is still over there, and Luis de la Sierra is still there. Just didn't have a big enough table, so you can ask them questions. Too. Sarah.
I just wanted to comment on the idea of practice and sleep, and also whether we should be changing the way that perhaps we learn things in school, the way that we're training people to do different tasks, and the way that perhaps we could work with our sleep schedules. I'm looking at the relationship between increasing practice and whether sleep can actually interfere, or no, whether increasing practice can interfere with the sleep-dependent learning that we're looking at. And what I'm actually finding is not only that when you continue to do these tasks over and over again, you get worse and worse and worse at them without sleep, but also in new data that I'm writing now, actually, it seems as though the information that you're allowing to come in, to learn from it, you actually only need a little bit of information to learn. And then you continue to practice, and you get worse, but it's not going to actually make you learn any better, and it actually may not even make you learn any particularly worse, but that there's two things working in parallel, so that you have a learning system that's taking in information, trying to find new information, trying to look for the signal, and then you also have, say, the muscle, right? The muscle that's actually working out and trying to, the visual muscle or the arm muscle that's doing the motor learning. And what is the difference, I guess, is what I'm interested in, is what is the difference between that learning mechanism that only really needs a little bit of information to learn a whole lot, and then continuing to practice that information? Does that actually help? Are we fatiguing a system that doesn't really need to be fatigued, that we should actually start looking at what is the optimal amount of practice for continued learning? And then can we then be stopping a lot of these fatigue-related accidents that have to do with overstimulation of, say, the muscle system and not necessarily the learning system?
Any takers on that?
There's a lot of work that's been done, and I think as you're probably familiar with, in the psychological literature, going back to Ebbinghaus 100 years ago, about optimal spacing. So if you have, say, a total of 2 hours to study some material, are you better off spending 2 hours and then and no study for the rest of the week, or spacing, say, 10 minutes a day for each day for a week? And what he showed was that if you want short-term retention, if you want to get a good grade on the test tomorrow, you're better off with the 2 hours just before the exam. But if you want to retain it next year, you're better off spacing it. So that's very well established over many different types of material, and it's been actually we have a project here at UCSD in the Science of Learning Center that Hal Paschler is organizing at the Preuss School, which is a charter school on campus, to actually do this in a practical setting in K-12 school. And the data are coming out really beautifully. And so actually, I think that you're right. You don't want to, in fact, spend all your time practicing it all at the same time, at the same day. You do want to space it out.
Eric, your experience is in your clinic is with people who have a whole world of problems, usually. But do you have a comment about thoughts about medications and pushing the envelope for general populations?
Medications in regard to keeping awake or keeping asleep? Or
yes, both.
Well, either way. I get a little holistic, and if I can avoid using any medication, because I haven't found a medicine that doesn't have a side effect, even excessive water in young women marathoners has been known to cause cardiac dysrhythmia and death. So if I don't have to give them a pill or something to stick in their mouth and to something to condition, to become dependent upon, I rarely give a sleep medication, unless it's narcolepsy. And then that's mother's milk, and that's a different issue. But in regards to most sleep disorder medicine, I go back to the basic. It's, 33.333% of all medicines start out with history and physical. And retrospectively, through a lot of the research that we've talked about over the last 2 days, we've been able to ask the right questions. You know, it's always intrinsic to the animal. And one of the reasons why sleep medicine's branch medicine, its relative infancy, is that basis of history. How do you ask a question about a pathology when the person's sound asleep during all the problems? Where are you snoring? I don't know. I sleep alone. I live in Iowa. No one sleeps. I mean, you don't have a lot of pointed questions. And in fact, half the patients with the sleepiness problems don't know they're sleeping until they fall asleep behind the wheel of a 40-ton rig. And then we all get to read about that or see about that on the news. But in general, we like to start with a history and physical examination and ask if there is a problem with initiating, maintaining sleep. Is it a full 6.5 to 7.5 hours of sleep? Do you feel rested when you wake up? Do you fall asleep at inappropriate times, especially driving a car when my kids are standing out there at the bus stop? Find out if there is indeed a problem. And in fact, that bell-shaped curve we haven't really addressed to any great extent, but the little old lady who comes in and says, "Doctor, I need a pill. I need it really bad. I only sleep 3.5 hours at night." She's an 85-year-old lady. I said, "Well, when do you go to bed?" She tells me. "Do you have a restful sleep?" "Yeah, I think so." "You wake up? You feel rested?" "Yeah." "Fall asleep at inappropriate times during the day?" "Nope." "Well, what's your problem?" "Well, I've got a new roommate at the senior citizen place, and she sleeps normally, and I got to get something to put me out because I keep her up all night." Not really a problem. She really doesn't need, in my opinion, she's a short sleeper. I'm not going to give her any medication. So I'm really reluctant to use medications except in issues like narcolepsy, where I think it's mother's milk. REM sleep behavior disorder, and I'm sure they don't have obstructive sleep apnea that's going to be compromised by that clonazepam, because I can bury my mistakes. So I'm very hesitant in that regard. But clonazepam and some REM sleep behavior disorder, tremendous medication.
Okay, thanks. So, David, your position on lifestyle medications for sleep?
Well, I think scientifically sound evidence for medications that help people cope with sleepiness or with sleep in a way that cannot otherwise be helped have a place. So, for me, it's a matter of the evidence. But there's no question that there is a desire on the part of lots of people who don't have disorders to try to find some way to continue to live with less sleep. And I didn't give you a talk on caffeine and the staggering amount of caffeine being consumed, the proportion of the population addicted to the substance now, and the fact that we can't have a meeting or do anything without it, is all an indication that you know, people are trying very much to promote their wakefulness and alertness and their functional capability. It's an ethically thorny area, how far we go here enhancing performance. It's not the only area of performance enhancement, but I think we're seeing a cultural demand for performance-enhancing foods and drugs and technologies that are intended to allow people to go longer without sleep, and there's an unknown consequence to that, I think. And I think the epidemiologic data around obesity, sleep duration, possibly mortality, and that may be relevant to that. It's a little hard to know if it's connected causally or not, as we talked when Dan presented.
Do you get enough sleep, Bob?
I actually am going to die early. I'm one of those 8-hour a night sleepers.
Julio, how much do you sleep?
Well, six.
Six. Terry?
Six.
I've seen it, isn't it? David?
It's model specific, do you notice?
8 or 9 if I can get it, but...
You complain about people giving you these surveys. You're always on the road, you're in planes and so on.
Well, so that's the point, and I think, I don't remember if I said it here or one of the other talks, it is astonishing to me that we have sleep meetings and chronobiology meetings, and I was in Paris once, and we were all jet-lagged. We'd all come from the United States. We're standing there giving a talk, and I'm giving my talk, and I'm watching half of the audience of scientists sound asleep. I'm thinking, here is the classic example that we actually are not fixed awake or fixed asleep. We're fluctuating in and out of these states as we take in the environment or function with it, and maybe that's the natural condition of human beings. Maybe it's a little silly to think of us as always asleep and trying to create that when we're in our sleep period or always awake. But there's no question that we completely ignore by social practice the biological limits of this system. Do we do that at our peril or not, I think, is a hot debate, one that needs evidence. I don't know. It may be fine. In the end, it may be disastrous.
Gary?
Well, I tell you, almost any time I give a talk, I'm jet-lagged. I'm jet-lagged right now, and I came from... a 2-hour drive from the north. when you're at meetings.
But before that, you came from a sleep meeting in Bangkok.
Well,
right?
That's true, but I am jet lagged when I go north south as well, even short distances. I go from Los Angeles to Santa Barbara, I have jet lag. But I did want to make another point. Maybe you want to go to Dan's answer first.
No, go ahead.
No, make your point.
This issue of is sleep for the brain, I think it's important to distinguish between sleep being generated by the brain, which there's no question. Sleep is generated by the brain. Respiration is generated by the brain. Eating is generated by the brain. But these heart rate is controlled by the brain. There's no question about that, but there's no question the non-sleep functions that I just mentioned are not primarily for the brain, although the brain certainly benefits from having your heart beating and breathing and so on, but they're bodily functions. And I think most of the evidence for sleep function is based on the duration and intensity of sleep under different conditions with different tasks, with changes in body temperature, and so on. If you use that measure across species, the evidence that sleep is for the brain is very poor. There is no relationship between brain-body weight ratio and sleep time, and there is nothing unique about human sleep in terms of sleep time. So this idea that the primary functions of sleep all concern the brain, and I'm not saying that they may not be brain functions, but sleep time does not seem to be related in any simple way to brain size, to cortex subcortical ratios, to brain body weight ratios. And if you assume that there are unique aspects to human brain function, which I think we all assume with good justification, this is not reflected in sleep parameters.
Could you go remind me of something in your talk. When you looked at social species, I mean social animals, animals navigating through social space on a daily basis, was there a shift, was there a change there? Was there a cohort that you could pull out and say, well, that's a tiring activity. They needed more sleep. Forming more networks to describe their activities. They're storing all this stuff.
I went through the range of sleep in various orders of mammals, and my point was that if you know an animal's a primate, if you know an animal's a rodent, if you know an animal's a bat, you know nothing about sleep, because despite the shared genes and shared physiology of animals in particular orders, there's a wide range of an overlapping and wide range across all orders. So it doesn't seem, and you know, social behavior would go along with this. It doesn't seem that the things that orders of animals have in common, like we think of primates as smart, high brain body weight ratios, that doesn't, as a group, distinguish us from other animals in terms of REM sleep amount, non-REM sleep amount, percent time devoted to REM sleep. Whatever theory you eventually come up with, that's something that has to be explained, that there is this enormous range of sleep that seems independent of the commonalities in genes shared by orders of animals.
But if you took us out of the mix, and so if you compared, say, rhesus macaques with orangs, is there any major difference there, do we know?
Well, I don't think that orangutans have been studied, so I don't know what you mean, that there's a social difference there?
Yeah, I would say.
I think people have looked at all sorts of variables, and I know because I've been asked to review a number of these papers. There's a whole bunch of papers floating around with correlating everything with sleep, with the expectation that if you just find the right thing, you'll find sleep is linearly related to safety of sleep site, or if you weight safety of sleep site and density, you know, caloric density, and all these things. You can do that, and I think ultimately that, you know, it's multifactorial because sleep evolved, like other things, for survival of species, and it's efficient for animals to sleep. It's not a state that takes away from survival functions. It is a survival function,
right.
And so in different ecological niches, different amounts of sleep are adaptive. And I know actually the two speakers today weren't here when I gave these examples, so I'll repeat them. If you're a bat and you eat bugs and the bugs are out from 6 to 8 p.m., it makes sense for you to be awake from 6 to 8 p.m., and it makes sense for you to be asleep the rest of the 20 hours of the day, the 22 hours of the day, and that's what they do. And there's every reason to think that that's adaptive, has nothing to do with their learning better to chase bugs that prior day. It's just adaptive for them to be asleep. And humans, actually, to the extent you compare humans to other species, we sleep very little, and Dan's data suggests that we're evolving towards a lower sleep time as our cognitive activity increases. Of course, the pharmacology is driving it faster, and whether that's a good thing or not is another issue. But the idea, you know, as Alan Hobson put it in the title to his talk, sleep is of the brain, by the brain, and for the brain, I would agree with the first two points, but I think the third point, the evidence does not support that, and that's an important
point. Okay, now I know the whole world would like to know how long Dan Kripke speaks, sleeps, but you had a point to follow up on.
Yeah, I would like to comment on that briefly, because this I think is the value also of formulating some hypothesis that in the end is a cellular hypothesis, and that most likely is going to be wrong. But it focuses our thinking. What you say is certainly true. Anything like sleep, anything so major, must serve an adaptive purpose, will be molded by adaptive purposes. A bat will do exactly that. And I always face the problem when I just in my lab between fruit flies who sleep even more than we do and ourselves, okay? And if you think that it's a mere function of, you know, how much they learn and how good they are cognitively, of course it doesn't make any sense to think of sleep that way. So yes, the niche in which the animal lives is fundamental in determining how long they sleep, when they sleep, and all of that. But the thing that I was trying to emphasize is that it looks like there is a price to being awake. And that being awake has been shown, you know, the prize, much of that has been shown by David, and of course by many, many other people. The question is, what is that price? Because that is where the homeostatic regulation of sleep comes in. And it suggests definitely that staying awake longer, or some kind of wakefulness especially, are going to present a burden to some organs and perhaps to some functioning of those organs. What I'm saying specifically is it's probably the brain and it's probably plasticity. It's the price for plasticity. Now, you can do it in a few hours, in many hours. A very good example is human short sleepers that can do with 2-3 hours what we do with 6, 7, 8 hours, and they are just as well. And if you look at them carefully, and that's an indication, they have only stage 4 sleep and REM sleep. That's all they have. So it also suggests to you that maybe this price can be repaid with very different mechanisms. If you've got the right mechanism, you can do it fast. If you don't have the right mechanism, it takes much longer. But we should keep in mind that while sleep has been adapted over millions of years to the echo niche, there is also a price to be paid for wakefulness.
I think the critical question bouncing around is its function, cellular function, essential, or is it vestigial as an activity physiologically, and could we get rid of it once we understand the mechanisms and substitute something chemical or otherwise to get rid of it? I'm not sure we're evolving the sleep less, Jerry. I don't see a lot of evidence of that. But the question of trying to actively manipulate it or eliminate it seems to be something that at least our species wants to do. I don't see the tigers But remember, we're the species. You know, the birds have been around a long time as pteropods. They didn't go to the moon. Crocodilia did not invent shift work. Okay, just a reminder to all of you that something, you know, our prefrontal cortex cooks up these ideas about controlling our world, and we're actively involved in controlling our biology too. So it doesn't surprise me that as a species, this becomes a question: why do we do this, and can we get rid of it? Because we want more time or whatever. But I really think, is it vestigial and just hanging around out there? It's a timing system that regulates our timeouts, and we could block it. Or does it serve a vital cellular function that without it, we're really not quite the great ape we think we are, or whatever we want to call ourselves?
Luis, did you have a point on that?
No, yes, sir. Yeah.
How long do you see?
7 hours. 7 hours. With kids, right?
Philip?
Yeah, if you have kids, you tend to be quiet no matter what.
About 7 hours without kids.
See, the problem here is you're all answering this question, but that's not the truth. The right. truth is some nights...
It's self-report.
Some nights 4, some nights 6, some nights 8, on a weekend 10. That's the truth. And that's never captured in these global statements about sleep. In fact, you're as influenced by the demand characteristics in this room as you are by your own introspection. So it's folly to do this.
It's also
folly.
Time in bed. It's also
it's
time in bed that you're
folly.
Saying.
And it's time in bed. Thank you.
No, just a quick comment regarding the cellular functions of sleep. I mean, from the array data, it's clear that if you sleep deprive an animal, you're going to have molecular consequences, which are mostly a consequence of cellular stress. So no matter whether the species has consolidated its sleep or non-consolidated its sleep, so obviously sleep has a restorative and cellular function in the brain. I don't think there's, and no matter which part of the brain you dissect, that's basically the fact that you increase stress in the neurons, and that's how the brain responds to increased wakefulness. Obviously, during sleep, everything, all the metabolism, all the steady state goes down, and that's, I don't think that's vestigial. I think that's an actual cellular function.
So, well, as David has said, one of the mysteries is why a 10-minute nap should be restorative when we often sleep 6-8 hours a night. We've done some 24-hour EEGs and a lot of 24-hour actigraphs, and one thing that mainly in aging people, and one thing that surprises us is that at least in the older people, we see a lot of sleep in the first 2 hours after waking up. And we also see a lot of sleep in the last 2 hours before bedtime in what's supposed to be the forbidden zone. So I think many of our concepts come from in-bed sleep recordings. When we actually record people and look at the records throughout the 24 hours, we see all these little naps at other times that I think they're there. I'm not sure how much they're there, and I think we've been looking too little about that. Whether they have an adaptive purpose, I don't know.
Any questions from the audience, by the way? Julia's going to have to go fairly shortly. I wonder why it is that even when you wake up normally, it still takes you ages to get out of bed. Have you thought about that?
Sleep inertia.
Yeah.
First of all, I want to thank you, Roger, and all of the speakers for having me turn my thinking on its head. And to reward you for that, I'd like to throw out an idea that just came to me like a water molecule in an MRI. Maybe Roger's going to have to put on a conference instead of calling it waking to sleep, falling asleep to wake. I don't think this is an original idea with me. But the question is, what is the purpose of waking? What is the drive to wake? And certainly nobody can go a day without waking. And
the difference is that you can easily list several functions for waking, but sleep researchers have trouble starting at number one.
And yet the genetic programs that time us out are so relentless. I mean, I'm impressed by the circadian control of our behavior and that we share that with so many animals. And what that says is even though our consciousness and the size of our brain and our prefrontal cortex all may be relatively new in the evolutionary time span events for an organism, bottom line is that we're still carrying all that genetic machinery that requires us to adhere to the orbital mechanics of this planet, and to our physiologic functions still primarily depend upon it, and probably the cellular functions of the brain as well. It's just that where we're headed, if Julio and Jerry and Terry are all successful, is would we start to screw around with that if we could manipulate it? That what I hear humans saying is, yes, let's do it. You know, in a college class, if I say, how many of you, if I had something absolutely safe, never mind FDA, this is a food, it's totally safe, can't hurt you in any way, no downside whatsoever, but it'll substitute for sleep, and you can be awake 24 hours a day, every hand in the room goes up and says, I'll take that. So the next generation comes is going to do what every other generation before them's done and say, yeah, I'll take that, I'll do that.
Also, it's an actual interesting question. I had this discussion with some people. Stop and think about whether you would actually be happy. If I could give you a shot now, perfectly harmless, that would guarantee that you would not sleep another minute, nor need to, for the next 5 years.
And then what?
And then you'd be fine.
Okay.
Then
you sleep for the next 2 years, right?
Nope, just like that.
I mean, the greatest part of running a marathon is the recovery afterwards. And there's nothing greater in the world than pounding your head against the asphalt for 26.2 miles than sleeping.
I would agree, and in fact, in our sleep deprivation studies, that sleep of the dead, that first recovery night when we let people sleep when they wake up, or the second night, depending on how severely deprived they were, that just feels wonderful. People say, oh, God, that was so good, you know. And what they're really talking about is how good it feels to be awake, how easy and effortless it is to be awake. But so many of us are so underslept at times, we're struggling with wakefulness. We take our caffeine. We can't pay attention. We're struggling and struggling. We don't know how good it feels to just be awake without effort.
You know, there is a natural substance, electromagnetic energy, which actually does reduce the time that you sleep. I was struck when I went to a meeting in Helsinki in the middle of the summer, in Iceland, actually, a few years later, at the partying that was going on at midnight. People seemed to be just getting revved up. And they also get up early in the morning. So, I mean, during that entire summer time up north, that light just enervates. I mean, it's just incredibly, it's just sort of, I mean, we know that, in fact, light entrains the circadian rhythm. But
it also has an alerting effect separate from that. There are actual published studies of light's alerting effects independent of.
Alerting, did you say?
Alerting, yeah.
Alerting, okay.
So independent of its phase-shifting properties, it has alerting effects. We're a cave ape. So all these things we call buildings are caves, and we put this incredibly low light in them. Okay, if we actually put 5, 10,000 lux of light in here, we'd be squinting, but the bottom line is we'd probably be more alert.
Yeah, it's true. Energizing, there's no doubt about it. And maybe that's the solution. The magic pill is light.
So fight for that office near the with a window and we're facing the sun.
There's a question over there.
This question is mainly for Giulio, but anybody can answer it, I guess. One of the most salient things about being asleep is being unconscious and not remembering much of anything. If you're lucky, maybe a little bit of a short stretch of REM sleep, dream. You mentioned the possibility or the wish or the conceivability of doing things while you're awake that would preserve the same function as sleep. What'd you have in mind?
Well, there are two aspects to your question. The first one is how much is going through your mind while you're asleep. You are unconscious, certainly, of the external world, but whether you are completely unconscious is a different story. In fact, all studies indicate that there is, people call it in horrible ways, cognition, cognitive activity, but basically consciousness to some extent, during most of sleep, except for perhaps deep sleep, stage 3 and 4, early in the night. And that means we have to qualify the term consciousness here. We are unconscious of the environment to a large extent, but it doesn't mean we are always unconscious. In fact, we dream most of the time. The fact that you cannot learn in that situation, which I started with that slide, is certainly true. It has been demonstrated by various studies and by the fact that none of these companies that sell you those gadgets have been particularly successful. It has also, I believe, been demonstrated by studies of induction of LTP or things of that sort during sleep. It's very difficult to do that during non-REM sleep. The same parameters that work during wakefulness, they don't work during non-REM sleep. And there must be a reason for that. All the cellular correlates of that do not show up during non-REM sleep, the ones that are associated with acquiring new memories. So there must be a reason for that too. And finally, I must go back because I just loved it. Your example of the kind of delirious talking of the guy who was half asleep in sleep inertia. Okay, if that is the kind of activity, and certainly that's true for my dreams, that goes on most of the time during the night, if you turn on the memory switch so that you strengthen synapses as if that were sort of a rehearsal, a free rehearsal of waking experiences, that's the first thing I think of. You are going to ruin your brain completely. In fact, I think maybe in some psychiatric disorders, that's what may happen. You turn on the switch inadvertently while you're asleep, and you are going to ruin your memories. You're going to confuse what's true and what's not true, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's one of the key things to keep in mind. There is cognitive activity going on, and it must be, given that everything is reactivated to some extent. But whether that is what you want to remember, it's a very different story.
Now, I would just want to second that. I think everyone has the experience of waking up from a dream, and then if you instead of writing it down, walk to the bathroom, it's gone. And it makes you think that there's a reason why it's gone, why the systems are turned off. And that, I think, also speaks to this issue of replay during sleep. To the extent that we have access to replay, if you assume that what goes on in the brain has cognitive consequences and that when we remember dreams it has something to do with what was going on in the brain, that the kinds of dreams that we do remember don't usually correspond to what we learned in any orthogonal way. You may have a dream about being in a lab and having someone who's threatening or friendly or nice. The emotional aspects come through in dreams, and that's been shown many times. But it's pretty rare that you're seeing groups of letters in the dream and rehearsing them. We don't rehearse what we heard during the day. We deal with the experience.
We've actually done the experiment and published it a few years ago, where we looked to ask whether when people say about a dream report, oh, this element in the dream was caused, you know, I know why I had this thing happen in my dream because this happened during waking. We asked, how often is it a replay of what actually happened? And the answer is close enough to zero to think it might be zero. I mean, we got 1 to 2% out of about 500 dreams that might have been actual replay. So the statement would be that that's not what dreaming is about and that that's not what those brain functions are about. They're not trying to simply strengthen a memory that was formed during the day. But rather what it looks like, and this is some of the sleep onset studies we've done, looking over time at the progression of dreams related to waking activities, is that the brain is working its way through associative networks. It's the basic function of creating meaning in our lives. The way we create meaning is by taking events in our life and fitting them in with everything else in our lives. So after September 11th, everybody came away saying, I don't understand what just happened. What does that mean? And if somebody walked up to you and said, well, what it means is that if you fly a plane with a lot of gasoline into a building, it's going to explode. They say, no, that's not what I'm talking. I know what it means. I just don't know what it means. And that's a process of taking the information that we get in day by day and building it into our personality, our sense of self, and our understanding of the world. It's not that we want to know what should we do if we see a plane crashing into a big building tomorrow. That we have the answer to. It's, do I trust that person sitting on the plane next to me? Is it safe to go to New York and walk around? That involves integrating huge bodies of information and extracting commonalities, extracting patterns, making predictions about how we might best perform in the future. Someone said to me in the last day that we should think about dreaming as being dreaming of the future and not of the past. And that might be the evolutionary value, that what we're doing is we're trying to learn, based on what we've experienced in the past, what we should do in imaginable situations in the future, not in the situation that we saw in the past.
So I would agree, with the exception that I think it's both the past and the future. I'm
okay.
Often struck by, it's not so much the content I remember when I awaken in the morning of what happened, as the action plan I now have for solving a problem that I didn't have when I went to bed and was on my mind. And I've gotten so interested in this, I keep track of it, and it seems like nearly every morning I've got an action plan for something. It might be a small issue or a big one, and it strikes me the brain is, in fact, integrating in some way, and it's opening up potential solutions for action plans.
And it's not doing it in a top-down way. You don't wake up.
Necessarily.
You don't wake up and say, okay, you know what? I've gone over all the pluses and minuses, and it looks like that minus only has a weight of
0.7. But the action plan might involve emotion.
Yes.
It might also involve motor activity. So awakenings from these slow wave sleep, I'm always struck by in these sudden awakenings, you get automatic behavior. I mean, Eric talked about this and showed us this, but we even have these bizarre cases where people engage in elaborate parasomnic states. They're walking around, they're disoriented. Even these alleged killings that sometimes the person gets seen as having been dissociated from this inertia and other times not, depending on the court. But there's no question that complex behavior can emerge when an inappropriate arousal occurs and reveal itself, just like REM behavior disorder shows. There's this violence associated. Now, it's mostly in men, and it's older men, and I mean, there's some very curious stuff here, but it suggests there are protective periods where programs are played in the brain around action plans, around defense, aggression, all sorts of things. And then supposedly, if you don't mess with those states and you let them follow their time course, and there are time constants in it, in my world, that's how we think of everything. So Dan, the 10-minute naps, which I'm impressed with, there's a time constant to them. What we want to know is not do they help you, how long do they help you? In other words, when do you run out of gas again? I think the time constants are where a lot of the action is for understanding how this biology benefits us and how we integrate it and how we model it mathematically, actually.
There was something that Bump said in his talk after Julio's presentation, which we didn't quite get to, which was the whole notion of emotion-laden recall, and it struck me that I was then started thinking about the Crick-Mitchison hypothesis again, that the notion that what the brain is doing at night while you're sleeping is essentially taking out neural trash and you're cleaning up sort of stuff. But the stuff that you retain, to use that weak metaphor...
No, actually, that's wrong. That's not what Crick and Mitchison... I mean, that's an interpretation of what they said.
I know that's not what they said.
The unlearning hypothesis, to make it put on the table so that we talk about it in a precise way, it fits in actually with some of the things that Julia was saying, is that their view, with their intuition came from these associative networks and spurious states that occur as interference between two memories that are stored that have overlapping neurons. And the idea was that when you go to sleep, what you do is you just randomly recreate combinations of states in the network, and you unlearn. You decrease the strengths of the synapses to decrease effectively. You actually are decreasing the strengths of the actual memories, but more importantly, you're getting rid of that interference.
What they call parasitic nodes.
Parasitic, that's right, the parasitic memories. And so it actually, even though it was in a very different computational framework, actually has a lot of similarity with the more modern ideas that we have now based on more physiological mechanisms. And some of the... again, I want to point out that there may not be just one mechanism that is relevant. In other words, it could be that there are... we know there are several phases of sleep, so, I mean, there may be several important mechanisms that have to be integrated.
I would like to follow up on this, actually.
But could I just finish the point, which was that even if that were a metaphor, and thank you for the clarification on that, even if that were a metaphor, you were talking about retention of preferential retention of emotion-laden material rather than what you called neutral material.
So the question is, I mean, there's sort of the smart model of sleep and memory and the dumb model. And the dumb model basically says everybody gets strengthened or all the synapses get weakened, and it's across the board carte blanche. The smart model says that there are some processes that are still magical in that sense that, who talked about magical? Someone used that phrase. Magical processes in the sense that we don't understand them at all yet, by which the brain does a selective reinforcement and weakening, and it identifies memories or networks or nodes that are useful and worth maintaining, and those might be strengthened, and others that appear not to be, and those might be weakened. And one of the algorithms, and again, absolutely just one of many possible simultaneous mechanisms, is that emotions in dreams are used as a metric, that if you construct a dream that has that arouses strong affect, the prediction would be that that association that you've created has some value to you, either positive or negative. Whereas if it comes across rather banal, I have a dream report from someone of seeing a squirrel making skiing motions. You know, those are the sorts that you might think just get kind of wiped out. But the idea of a smart system is that there might be a rule that says that a memory that has emotion attached to it will be selectively reinforced because almost by definition it has been identified as being of value. And there are studies from Born's lab and now Matt Walker, my colleague, and the short piece I gave there showing that they are preferentially strengthened or enhanced or retained across sleep compared to neutral memories. And in some cases, Jan Born's group has shown that while simple declarative memory seems to correlate with slow wave sleep or early night sleep, that emotional memories correlate with REM sleep or late night sleep. So again, that different in multiple sleep stages might be teasing apart different factors which get differentially enhanced or weakened across the night.
Philip, you had a point?
Yeah, I have two quick points. The first is about technology, because we were addressing the control of sleep. And I think the public needs to know that as far as our methods, we still live in the 18th century. In the sense that we sleep a third of our lives, and the interhuman, the agreement rate across cores is about 75%, right? So it's about 8.5% of biological data, which we still don't know how to understand. And when we talk about the importance of sleep states, we like to speak about them in isolation. But turns out that our best studies are the ones when we don't actually interfere with particular sleep states and we look at correlations. Because when we try to do that, If we look at the, you know, what we would call the nec plus ultra of deprivation, right now, one of the least stressful methods for example, REM deprivation would entail just gently handling an animal during REM sleep. And some of the other methods entail just putting an animal on a disc and then it falls into shallow water as soon as it loses muscle tone. That's stressful. And we have plenty of stress artifacts to think about still.
But still, we're the only animal that volunteers for sleep deprivation, no matter how you sleep deprive another animal.
Well, I would say that college students are the only animals who volunteer for sleep deprivation.
No, they're not, and we don't study them. Lots of people will volunteer for sleep deprivation.
I see.
But not rodents don't volunteer. So whether it's gentle handling or whatever you're doing, you don't know what they're thinking about what's going on.
But nevertheless, I would argue that being thrown into shallow water when you're sleeping is actually more stressful than being thrown into shallow water when you're awake.
I would tend to agree.
Right. And therefore, the controls which we generally have for stress are not that great. So in terms of the earlier question, which is, can we manipulate sleep, we still don't actually know exactly what is going on, and we need to develop new technologies in order to do that.
So Julia actually has to leave, so we can go on for a couple more minutes, but thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Don't forget your computer.
I just wanted to make
a couple of comments.
And I'm sure David will want to say something about the fact that we live in a culture that is where it's considered really weak and inappropriate and frankly dumb to sleep very much, and that this becomes a demographic and epidemiological problem for the culture, that we are driven to be short sleepers even if we don't particularly want to be. And I remember this quote from Bill Gates that I love so much. He was quoted as saying that his programmers were so tough, notice the adjective, so tough, that if they had a deadline coming up for a product release, they could program 72 hours straight without sleep. And of course the product was Windows.
Yeah, but Bob, I think it isn't so much the moral argument against sleep anymore. That was sort of a 20th century thing. What you hear now is we cannot do otherwise. Our economy depends upon people being awake. You know, you all want fresh fruit in the morning. Well, all those refrigerated trucks, thousands of them have to drive at night, et cetera, et cetera. So what's happened is everybody now acknowledges, oh, yes, you know, it'd be good to get sleep. It's not a good idea to go without it. But in reality, we have built large-scale global economic systems, information systems that now not only demand more people be awake, they also are enticing people to be awake. I mean, I can have a lot of fun at night from my home, right? Just get on the internet and cell phone, and I can get nearly everything I want, and it appeals to my consciousness. So I want to know, I'm going to Houston tomorrow. I want to know, what's the weather in Houston? Well, in a matter of seconds, I can have that. Okay, and so we create the world like our consciousness, and then we're befuddled by the biological limits put on us by the genetics of sleep and circadian clocks, and I don't know how to fix that. All I know is most agencies won't fund us to tell people to sleep. They fund us to find a way, if they have to sleep, to predict when we can get the optimal.
There is one other point, a brief point here that we went over before that sort of shocked me, which is your comment. Is this still the case that in the United States, despite the evidence that was shown, that cockpit napping is
Yeah, it's very hard to make public policy change, and maybe that's what we should end on, which is if you're going to make any change a change, you know, it's hard to make policy. These systems are intractable to evidence of harm. That's why it isn't like we just discovered the obesity epidemic. The CDC website that's been tracking the growth of obesity, if you look it up and show what's happening in every state, they've seen this signal coming for years. We just cannot turn. It's a little like our problem with the environment. Now, we have a hard time starting to make the change and trying to turn it around. And everybody wants somebody else to do it. Like, yes, so the federal regulators will say the pilots The pilots need to stay within their duty hours. They need their sleep. And I'll say, what about air traffic controllers? They say, no, they work for us. We're not going to mess with that. We're not. And so everybody's got this, you know, we're all, like truckers. Someone Everybody else. Likes to beat up on truckers. They're like a kind of social underclass, right? Well, yeah, okay. They're the safest drivers on the road, ladies and gentlemen. The accident per mile rate is the safest in trucking. You're the problem. You people driving are the problem. And everybody wants somebody else to make the sacrifice. And so Pogo had it right. We have met the enemy, and it is us. And when it comes to sleep, it's the same enemy and the same problem. And I think our vulnerable populations, our children, are where we have to make policy change and make it fast, around school start times or everything else, just as we're trying to do with food, because at least let's get the next generation off correctly. That would be my argument.
This has been fascinating. I just want to make a point that the Science Network has done a couple of three or four stem cell meetings. We actually started a stem cell meeting on the Mesa annually now. I'm hoping that this is the first of a sleep meeting that we'll be doing on the Mesa. We want to do an addiction meeting. We want to do an aging and life extension meeting. And eventually, perhaps, all those things will come together into an entire week, a sort of a wellness week on the Mesa as well. So. Thank you so much for being here. Somebody in the audience did suggest that we end with a quote from Shakespeare. I'm sure you know most of them, To Sleep, A Chance to Dream, and so on. But the one I actually like is in more archaic language. And I hope that when you get home this evening, you will enjoy the honey-heavy dew of slumber.
Excellent.
Thanks for being here.
Bravo.